So let's set our motivation. We do this by thinking of our situation here and the incredible number of positive causes and conditions that have to come together for us to be listening to the Dharma, reviewing what our teacher has taught us. And thinking about these kind of concepts, bodhicitta, renunciation, compassion, and we can deeply rejoice in this situation. So to have this kind of condition, we have to have created tons of really good karma. You can think about all your friends, family, enemies, strangers, how many of them are able to sit and listen to the authentic Dharma, to listen to a review of the words of an authentic teacher. Very, very few. So let's take a moment to just rejoice in that in our precious human lives. And through that we dispel our discouraged minds, which kind of yap at us all day. We can be happy and energized. And then we think about why we want to be here doing this. And we know that we want to end our own suffering. That's very clear to us. That we want to end the suffering of others. So we want to learn and figure out how to do this. And so we open up to this deep and incredible interdependence that we have with all beings. And we can think of His Holiness's words about His religion being kindness. And to listen to these teachings with that kind of heart. And uplift ourselves by thinking that it truly is possible for us to become Buddhas. And also remembering that we can only do this due to our connections with others. There's no individual self that's becoming a Buddha. It's becoming a Bodhisattva. It's impossible. So with this wonderful wish to end suffering for ourselves and others, then we listen to this review of the teachings. So set that motivation very clear in your mind and heart. So good evening, and we're really happy you're joining us again, or for the first time, either one, here at Srivasti Abbey. Venerable Thubten Chidrin and Venerable Tarpa and Venerable Sumten are off at an annual monastic conference in California. And actually, tomorrow night, Venerable Chidrin's going to be teaching in Portland, I believe, on the psychology of anger at Mayatripa Institute. So if anyone's listening and can make it to that or email someone in Portland and help them go to that, that would be lovely. So tonight, I have the grand pleasure of doing a review of some of the things we've been learning. And so I've chosen to focus on the advantages of bodhicitta and the 7-point cause and effect of developing bodhicitta. Something else I wanted to say there, but it'll come back. You can find these teachings by Venerable and listen to them. They're the kind of all throughout September. And then when we went into October, we had a retreat here on Shenrezig, so then we did some other things. But these are kind of sprinkled throughout September and then a little bit in October, just to kind of set the place where you might go listen again to Venerable herself. Okay, so she started out introducing, I think it was on September 1st, the Mahayana path. We had finished the looking at the hearers and solitary realizer paths. And she started right away by talking about that the five paths have the same names as when we study the hearer and solitary realizer paths, but they're called the Mahayana path of number one, accumulation, the Mahayana path of preparation, the Mahayana path of seeing, the Mahayana path of meditation, and the Mahayana path of no more learning. So because I'm going to be talking mostly about the review on bodhicitta, I'm just going to say a few words about the path of accumulation because it's tied in so tightly with bodhicitta. We enter the path of accumulation when we have spontaneous bodhicitta. This is a huge order. she said that and then started in the list of what we need to do to get there. And it's quite a tall order. First, we need to have renunciation, deep renunciation, solid renunciation, complete renunciation. So that's the determination to be free and to renounce what? Well, we don't have to renounce, as Venerable always says, chocolate cake or cupcakes or honey or any of our favorite things. What we're going to renounce is the suffering in our own minds in this type of a body. That's what we're renouncing. And that needs to be very clear. We get so confused about that. I'm confused about it to this very day. I have some kind of sense of renunciation means something like lock myself in a cell and hit myself with, you know, those kind of wire things, but that could be a little bit too, from my religious background, raised pretty fundamental Catholic, but we're all kind of affected by this Judeo-Christian kind of images throughout our lives, and so we've kind of learned that renunciation has something to do with being pretty miserable, and the reality is renunciation has to do with being very, very happy. So it's the determination to be free of what? Free of suffering. So it's actually happy. Well, that's just the first building block towards spontaneous bodhicitta. Because to get to renunciation, Venerable pointed out, we have to get compassion for ourselves. Okay, another tall order. How do we do this? Compassion being the deep wish to end the suffering. So then we go to the next building block to see the disadvantages of the way we're existing now. And that's kind of hard because we're constantly distracted by this, what Venerable calls low-level happiness. You know, I'll just go get my next movie, my next novel, my next meal, my next talk with my friends, my next visit to Starbucks, my next latte with almond flavoring. It's been a long time, but I do remember. And those will kind of get me through, you know, get me through the day. But this requires this constant repetitive meditation on, does this bring me happiness at the end of the day? You know, I'm $3 shorter from having the latte, and you know, how lasting was that? Kind of fleeting. So this is the way we look with everything. So we go looking over and over at these disadvantages of cyclic existence and no longer settling for this low-level happiness and saying, you know what, I want out. I want out. I want really, really out. I'm not satisfied with these things. It's kind of like hitting a glass ceiling and saying, that's not good enough. So to even get to that point, we're backing up again. I'm almost seeing a picture of the men that are moving our meditation hall. They keep building these platforms, and then they move it a little bit, and they tear the platform down, and then they build it. So these are the platforms that we have to build before we even get to spontaneous bodhicitta, which is just on the first path of accumulation. So now, how do we get to wanting out of cyclic existence? Well, we have to really fully understand karma and rebirth. Another tall order. I don't think I'll say too much about those tonight. Maybe we'll come back and maybe my friends who are here with me can say a little more. I am going to revisit rebirth. We will revisit that, but I'm not going to go into karma. A, because I don't understand it, and B, because it's long, and we're going to talk about bodhicitta more. So the other thing she said next was that bodhisattvas are not simply nice people. That is not the goal. And that's a confusion we definitely have in the culture. And when someone acts a little bit fierce on our behalf, kind of moving us out of suffering, we don't like it. At least I don't like it at first. I'll think, well, that wasn't nice. They should treat me better. I need respect. I need kindness. I need gentleness. I need it all the time, even for my self-centered attitude. I especially want my self-centered attitude to be treated with kindness. Well, if you're lucky, you get a teacher and you get Dharma friends who don't do that and who help you start seeing the difference. So that's what bodhisattvas do. They'll come in and jar you when you're stuck in that. And that's the courage of a bodhisattva. And she talked about it being way beyond being a nice person. It's not just a lovey-dovey kind of sweet compassion. So let's look at the definition. Bodhicitta is a specific mind, a specific consciousness, which is aimed at full enlightenment, complete, full Buddhahood, all the way, in order to free all beings. And it only wants the full enlightenment in order to do that. There's no other reason to go after the enlightenment. This is not for the one self alone. This is all out everybody. Now, this spontaneous aspect comes, and Venerable has said this so many times, and I'm just sometimes pretty stunned by how much my mind would have to change to get this. Spontaneous bodhicitta is when you look at anyone, anywhere. The men building the cabin, the cat, the mice, anybody, a spider biting you, someone screaming at you, and you look at that being and you think instantly, without effort, I want to free them and I'm going to become fully awake to do that. So that's where we're trying to go. Okay? So I don't know about you, but it seems like we'll have a little bit of work to do. So one of the ways that we can move towards that, and Venerable's also always saying, be content to create the causes. And that's becoming one of my very favorite sayings, because I can look at something so far out as spontaneous bodhicitta, feels very far away to me, and I can just go, and there's the discouraged mind, like, taking over right away. And so that's not going to help. So then I can come back to this place of, well, what am I doing right now? And I can be content to create a cause just today, some kind of cause today. So my cause today was getting ready for this talk was, oh, hi, Maitri. This is Maitri. She's joining us again for teachings. She hasn't been doing that. And maybe having some of my water. Okay, dear. You can stay up here. Let's make some room. So back to creating the causes. If each day you do some things, then you've done that, and then you want to rejoice in those. And I find this somewhat of a difficult habit to create. I more watch my mind, and it yaps at me. You know, it's like, you didn't do that right, and even though you did that, you could have done it better. And then it just kind of... it's like it pecks me to death, you know. That's the way I'm seeing it now, like it just peck, peck, peck. And I've started to say, stop already, just stop already. That is so not helping me. And if you have a mind like that, then feel free to just be very firm with it and just stop it. Thank goodness it's not all day, but it can really go after me sometimes and really push me into that kind of discouragement. And that's not very far from getting frustrated and angry. So at the end of each day, as Venerable says, then we look at what did I do today to create the causes, and we rejoice in that. And then we can also look at, so what could I do a little better tomorrow? But it's kind of like coaching yourself more than criticizing yourself. I'm sort of getting it now. It's more like mentoring or coaching yourself. How would I coach someone else? I wouldn't yap at them, and I wouldn't constantly point out what they've done wrong. Say, you know, this could be a little better, so let's try a little more for that, or what kind of help do you need with that? So really a compassionate mind towards ourselves. So one of the ways to work with this and get ourselves out of these the ditch of the swamps of despair is to look at the advantages of bodhicitta. So we're going to go after this, and we're going to cultivate it, and what's going to happen on the way? And it was really fun rereading these and re-listening to Venerable and really trying to grasp the wonder of this. And it came alive a whole lot more. So I hope tonight that can happen for you. First advantage of bodhicitta is it's the only gateway to the Mahayana path. So we want to be on the Mahayana path, right? I mean, as Venerable says, we're Americans, we want the best. Or we're Germans and we want the best. Or we're from Quebec and we want the best. You know, I mean, we want the best. So we're not going to settle for some halfway pathway here to enlightenment. And we want to be full Buddhas. That way we'll be of the very best help for everyone. And this is the only way to get through the gate, okay? So that's just clear as a bell. We're going to do this way. The second one is you become a child of the Buddha. Now, I've never liked that phrase because when I first ran into it, I thought, I'm a grown-up. Now, the people laughing the hardest are the ones that have lived with me the longest. So ignore them. The people who just got here, they're looking very kindly at me. But I just really had a hard time with this child of the Buddha thing. And so I would often cross out that and put, I'm a daughter of the Buddha. I liked that, you know, that felt good. A daughter of the Buddha, part of the Shakya clan. I liked that. But then Venerable was talking about this when she talked about these advantages. And I really, really liked this. She said, you'll become named as such. So it's like getting named into the family. So you can use the word daughter still, son of the Buddha. That's kind of nice. But you're named as such, and you will become a Buddha. It's like being born in a royal family. I really liked that idea. And so it's as though you're born as a little prince or princess, and you, as long as you're in that family, you're destined for the kingship and the queenship. So this is very cool, right? I mean, I wasn't born royal, so now maybe I can get in on some of that. And you inherit the family business of liberating all beings. So that's really how it's thought of. You become a son or daughter in the family, you inherit the business, and here's what the business is. So that's kind of nice. The third advantage of bodhicitta is you'll surpass in brilliance and in lineage the hearers and the solitary realizers. So we can use our competitive minds. I don't know. I had some trouble with this one too, because just because that competition thing came up. But I think the idea again is this born as a prince or princess with this guarantee. And brilliance is just because you'll have this extreme clarity. And what comes is as we include everyone and we don't leave anyone out, that mind has to be huge, and that mind has to be strong, and that mind has to be very, very bright, both bright intellectually, but bright, a bright, clear mind. So this is what we're going to get. The fourth one is you become an object of respect and of offerings due to your practice. So my self-centeredness just hijacks this totally. I mean, I just read this sentence and went, yeah, and, you know, I want respect, I want offerings, and there's the self-centeredness just hijacking it. It's like, that's not what it's about. So I kind of used this one and thought about it just to kind of watch that self-centeredness and think about, wow, how fast it comes up and gets right there about, yeah, I want them for me. This is for me, right? I will be respected. The others will be respecting me, and the offerings will be coming to me. So now I've completely forgotten my purpose, right? Bodhicitta's gone out the window. Didn't quite get it anyway, but now I way don't have it. So she mentioned that, guarding against that. But it would be nice to have respect and offerings, wouldn't it? And one of the things, I'm going to tell this story. Yeah, I'll wait till I get to that one. I'm going to tell about following Venerable around in Mexico. So the fifth thing is that we will easily complete the collection of merit and wisdom. Can you imagine that? An easy completion. I don't know about all of you, but it doesn't feel really easy yet. But bodhicitta, again, it makes our action so powerful and so effective. It's a vast mind. It's just huge. You see, beings are endless, and we can't even count them. Even, you know, Westerners will tell us that. We can't count even how many insects. And if we're going to include all of those and think of them as formerly our mothers and develop this deep compassion for them, our mind gets so huge, I can only just barely imagine. And then all the actions are incredibly powerful and effective. So of course we're going to need habituation and familiarity to root out this self-centeredness and grasping at a self. The grasping all the time, it's me, I'm solid, I'm here, I'm doing this review, am I doing okay, what's this cat going to do? You know, I mean, it's all so solid, but with this bodhicitta mind, that opens up. So this motivation's key, and it will take a long, long time to develop. So that was number five. The sixth advantage of bodhicitta is the obstacles of negative karma are eliminated. And that would be pretty amazing. And the mind becomes even more vast and powerful and has very strong purification because it's working for countless beings. So the strength grows, and any meritorious act you do, Venerable said, any purification you do with this mind of bodhicitta, including all beings, becomes stronger and stronger. So you can see that if I sit. Sometimes this happens in meditation, and I'm sure people watching too also experience it. I'll be sitting there and I'll be doing maybe Vajrasattva purification or something, and I'm just seeing it on myself, and then I'll suddenly go, oh, I think I want to include my mother, my brother, and all of a sudden it just opens up and it feels so powerful and so beautiful. And then start thinking, oh, I'll send that to the people in Africa and the people who are having war and, you know, the people doing this or that protest and the people who are protesting the protest. And you can just open it up and you start feeling it being very, very alive, I guess. It doesn't feel so deadened as it is with just one. So I think that's a small experience of what this could feel like. And number seven is what you wish for in general happens more easily. So virtuous wishes, I mean, Venerable said that, and then she stopped and said, well, virtuous wishes, of course. So I wanted to just say that I got a chance one time to travel with Venerable, and when she was teaching, and it was so amazing to me that all the way along the way, transportation showed up, people to carry things showed up, food showed up, beautiful houses to stay in showed up, people just kind of almost falling all over themselves. Can I help you? Can I make this happen? Can I take you there? Can I bring you more? And it was a beautiful, beautiful teaching for me about her bodhicitta is what creates that. You know, she's moving about the world that way, and these things just easily open up, and her even her regular wishes in life just appear and occur. And so I think as we develop these, that can happen. And if you look, people who've known Venerable very long at all, her wishes for this monastery, it's amazing what's happened in 7 years. Absolutely amazing. Land, buildings, all paid for, donations, more buildings coming, more monastics coming. It's just fantastic. So I think that's a model of this part of this, what can happen, this beautiful results of this. So the eighth one are, developing this prevents harm or interference from external enemies, and they are overcome by powerful love and compassion. And Venerable told the wonderful story of Shakyamuni Buddha and his cousin who, I don't know, I worry about Devadatta, but Devadatta kept trying to, he was very, really extremely jealous of the Buddha, and I think it's really stories about watching out for jealousy. He got very jealous of the way the Buddha had organized the Sangha and of the Buddha's successes, and he kept trying to interfere, and at one time he did take some Sangha away, and then I think Shariputra went over and talked with them and got them back, but Devadatta was really on a vendetta against his cousin, the Buddha, and he sent a mad, crazy elephant out to trample the Buddha, actually, and from a story that Thich Nhat Hanh tells in Old Path, White Clouds, people were really terrified of this elephant. It had been rampaging around, and they were all telling the Buddha, don't go out and don't go down there, but he felt he needed to teach that day, so he did, and Devadatta set this elephant out, and here he comes running at him, and everyone scattered, I guess, but Ananda, who in Thich Nhat Hanh's story, stood by the Buddha in front, and the elephant stopped right there from the power of the Buddha's compassion towards the elephant. So we have to get that this is the compassion towards the elephant, and maybe towards Ananda, maybe towards other people around. The Buddha's not concerned with himself, but he doesn't want the elephant to do something that's harmful. So he's able to stop that elephant. And there's many, many stories like this. When Lama Zopa was here during our first Vajrasattva, we had the incredible delight of having him here and with us during that time. And I loved this story he told because, again, of my Catholic background, but he told the story of St. Francis. Now, of course, we don't know that St. Francis had full-out bodhicitta, but he certainly had a degree of compassion. And Lama Zopa was talking about this same kind of power over external, so-called external things. He told about St. Francis doing the same thing with a wolf that was running around and devouring people and was really out of control. And people told St. Francis, don't go near it, it will kill you. And he went out and just talked to the wolf straight on, brother wolf. It's a very famous phrase, brother wolf. And he also, Lama Zopa said that Lama Yeshe went to Assisi and visited where St. Francis was, and that he was just delighted to be there and felt like the power was really wonderful there. And someone told them the story of St. Francis also turning water, a flood away, turning it from the town and being able to talk to Sister Water. And Lama Zopa said, this is the power of purification. So this is the power of that purification that can lead into this bodhisattva, bodhicitta mind. I like that. It's wonderful. So the other thing is that right now we have to manufacture this, right? I mean, we are going to be, Venerable says this in her book on Chenrezig practice, we're going to be dressing up. You know, we're like kids. We go to the closet and we get our parents' clothes out and we dress up like, you know, whatever you dressed up like, you know, the princess or the king or the doctor or the lawyer or whatever you were going to be, you know, the firefighter. And we're just putting the outfits on. But you do that and your mind shifts a little and you start playing around with the things and thinking, well, you know, maybe I could be one of these. Maybe I could be this, you know. My sister and brother and I used to play school and teaching all the time. It was like pretty amazing. And then I did end up teaching for quite a while. You know, it was like from that playing, you know, getting chalkboards out and chalk and scolding each other and books and memorizing and reciting back, that I got a sense of this is something maybe I could do. So this is how we'll have to do this for now. And we will be content to create the causes. Number 9, we complete the realizations of the path. Well, that's pretty amazing. All of our laziness is gone, Venerable said, just gone, and we just plain go for it. Now, this helps me understand, Venerable, a little better. This laziness that I have of grumping around, it's too hard, I'm too tired, I don't want to do it today, I'll do it tomorrow. But she was saying, everything gets done quickly, and the reason is our concentration gets very, very good. We're not distracted because all those distractions, there's no room in the mind for. We're really energized by this bodhicitta at this point. Just it kind of takes over the mind, she said, and there's just no room for distraction. And number 10, we enter the tantric path quickly, and therefore we reach awakening quickly. And number 11 is quite lovely. We become a source of comfort and happiness for all beings. So she was stopping there and saying, imagine being that, you know, a source of comfort and happiness for all beings, not just for some, not just your friends that like to call and talk to you or get, you know, cry on your shoulder and get a little help, but really for anyone who's in front of you. And so I was thinking of models of this, like His Holiness. He's such a source of comfort and happiness for the people of Tibet, people all over the world. I know for me in the morning, a lot of times when my mind is really low, if I think of him or I see his picture, I'm just really lifted up thinking about serving the Dharma on his behalf. Also Lama Zopa, how he's become a source of comfort and happiness for thousands and thousands of people. And as Venerable said, aren't the Buddhas this for us? Just the Buddhas. You think of the Buddha and you get some sense of comfort, some sense of happiness if we can put our minds there and keep it. And so we get to imagine being that and realize we're heading for that if we try for this bodhicitta, or as we try for it. And then the final one of this is, it was due to bodhicitta that the Buddha taught at all. He would never have taught the Dharma. In fact, the story is that he reached his enlightenment and he had kind of a debate with himself whether anyone would understand. And I think it was Brahma and one of the other Hindu gods came and said, yes, there are people with little dust in their eyes who will understand, so please do teach this. When you really think of it, though, the Buddha also only set out on the path to enlightenment due to his compassion and bodhicitta. There is no other reason he really wanted to do this. He wanted to be free, but he also wanted all others to be free. So at the end of this part, these advantages of bodhicitta, Venerable asked some questions, and she said, do we really wish the best for ourselves? You know, think about that. Do I really wish the best for myself? Do I really wish myself to be free of suffering? To have real lasting happiness and full liberation? And I sat with this, and what I thought is, you know what? Not yet. I don't. I'm trying for that, but to be very honest and starting where I am, I am not yet there. And I thought, well, what's that like then for me? And the analogy I got was looking at my actions of wanting to have a healthier body, but I don't do the things that lead to it that I know would. I still do caffeine, I still eat sugar, I don't do the exercises that Venerable Tarpa has taught me. take that part out. She took her precious time with, you know, she's got a physical therapy background and taught me these exercises for core strengthening. I don't do them. So it's like, I want that, but I don't really want to do the things. But I want it, but I don't want to do the things. So I think this is how the mind is early on with this. And I have to keep asking myself and invite you to ask yourself, do I really wish this best thing for myself? Because if I did, this is what I'd be cultivating every single moment, you know. I wouldn't be wasting any more time. And I wrote down, it's like I sort of want suffering to end. Isn't that gross? I mean, I'm remembering Venerable in our generosity retreat acted out our, like, complacency, and it was like this, well, I sort of want suffering to end, but, you know. It's like so gross looking at that mind. But when I'm honest, that's what I'm struggling with. So we look that the Buddhas really do want the greatest happiness for all of us completely equally. There's nobody more special than the next. So that's what we are trying for. So how do we move forward? Okay, now we're coming to the 7 point, to generating the altruistic intention. And the building block for that is equanimity. So before we jump into the 7 points, we need to take a look at equanimity. And I'm now sharing ideas from listening to Venerable's teachings and review, and also from the book that she edited, that's by Geshe Jampa Tekcho, The Transforming Adversity into Joy and Courage. So these ideas are mixed together. The equanimity precedes the 7-point cause and effect method because we have to create a mind stream free from attachment to some and aversion to others, and then just, I don't care, to the majority. Really, to the majority. I don't think about, you know, 99.9% of people in the world. Each day goes by and I haven't thought about them. I don't know them. They're not here, they're not in front of me, they're not causing me problems, and they're not particularly helping me. So we have to get past this. Geshe Tekchok says, this is just like leveling the ground before building a house. And I think it's like leveling the ground before moving a house. Because I was thinking, wow, what if we plopped that meditation hall down on uneven ground? That would be a big mistake. So we need to start with this equanimity. And we have to meditate many times on it, building a new habit, of course. Because for so long we've created attachments just for our small group. And you can see this, my group versus your group. My group's better, even for ourselves over everyone else. This set of aggregates more important than any set of aggregates out there to me. Oh, Ken doesn't agree. he thinks his is more important. This is the struggle, right? So I'm going to go over this fairly quickly because I want to get to the 7 point. But we work on this by meditating over and over, calling to mind 3 different people we put in 3 categories. People we stick the label on: friend, enemy, stranger. If you don't like the word enemy and that's too strong for you, difficult person. Now, we stick the label on, so the first thing to remember is, no one else labels them that. They might call your friend a stranger. There are more people who call your friend a stranger than who call that person a friend. So who's right about this? And is that an accurate label? There are more people who call your enemy a stranger than who call that person an enemy. Far more, millions more, billions. Well, there's 7 billion people in the world. Most of them would look and say stranger. You know? So what's that about? I mean, we really got to loosen up these minds, you know? And then, so then we remember too how easily these labels switch. I did divorce mediation for years. I did about 15 years of divorce mediation. And boy, there do you get to see it. I am so in love. I have to get married right now. And now I can't stand to live with you. I can't stand to be in the room and mediate with you. What happened? That person was the lover and now is the enemy. unbelievable. And this is 50% of divorces. 50% of marriages now end in divorce. So this is what our minds are doing. And you, of course, can call to mind whether you've been through a divorce or a breakup or whatever, someone who used to be your friend who you don't know really what their lives are now. So all of this, watching this, loosens this up. So we won't go through this meditation. I had been worried I wouldn't have enough material, but of course I have too much. But this is what you would do in this meditation. You think of these three, and you can put them in front of you, and you can meditate on how those labels have changed. There's another meditation I learned, which is you watch the person you've labeled as friend, and you imagine them doing something you don't like, because there are things we don't like our friends, you know, our friends do them, but just that little habit you don't like, and you just kind of watch it till your feeling kind of changes. Not my friend anymore. And then you watch the person you don't like, and you imagine them like saving the life of a child, or you imagine them, you know, you watch them and oh, they carefully move a bug out of danger. You go, wow, that was kind of nice. So you see how your mind can just flip-flop on tiny little actions, you know, now friend, not enemy, not stranger. You watch a stranger help an older person across the street in your imagination. Oh, they're not such a stranger anymore. They seem like they could be your friend. So we always ask ourselves then, how much difference is there between these people? Really, you know, how much difference is there between one of my best friends, Gloria, I still think of sometimes, and someone who is, you know, the guy down at the post office, Zach, that I see, you know, maybe once a week mailing packages. Much difference between them, because now she's kind of a stranger and Zach's kind of becoming a friend because we chat and found out he's from Czechoslovakia. And, you know, I mean, it's like, that's interesting, isn't it? You know? So we just can play with that all day. You don't have to be sitting on your cushion. How much difference is there between people? They're all suffering. We're all in that same boat. Everybody wants happiness. I'm like them, they're like me. Sometimes I use a shorthand when I see someone I'm not connecting to, and I try to remember this, and it's quite good if I do. I say, just like me. I say that when I look at the person, just in my own mind. Just like me, you know, and that kind of cuts it. So we do this over and over and over and learn to extend our openness to everyone more equally. So now, on to the 7-point cause and effect instructions. This is connected to the 37 practices of bodhisattvas too, to this one verse that I want to read because I really love this by Togme Sampo. It says, when your mothers who've loved you since time without beginning. So think about that. All your mothers had to love you since time beginning, since way back, because you couldn't live if they didn't. You know, we would be dead. And maybe some mothers didn't love us so much and we got abandoned and died. But then the next life, some mother picked up on it and saw us through. And clearly the mothers of this life did. We're here, we're listening to Dharma. They gave us a Dharma kind of life. I don't know that we can ever repay them. So, when they're suffering, what use is your own happiness? And I would even say, what possibility is our own happiness if we really think my mother's suffering? So I'll just go off and be happy. So, to free limitless living beings, develop the altruistic intention. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. So how do we develop this? Well, again, it's this primary consciousness that has two aspirations: to benefit all sentient beings, and keyword all, and to gain full awakening in order to do this. So Geshe Tekchok says, first we aspire to benefit others. And we try for this in all of our usual ways, you know, like I help my family, I help my friends, I do some social work, I do volunteer, I do activism, all of this. It's really great. There is nothing wrong with this. But when we do it after a while, we look and go, what were the long-term effects of that? You know, what were all the outcomes? How many people got deeply helped and moved along the path to enlightenment? And we see, that's a little bit discouraging. So then we look up, we come up against these limits, and then we see, I have to get more skills. I have to get more wisdom. I have to understand my own mind and my own situation here, because I'm helping, but it's really of limited benefits. And sometimes when I help, it actually goes the wrong direction. And the person comes back and says, that way wasn't helpful. So this is the situation we're in now. We want to become enlightened so that we can really see what's beneficial or not. So let's start with the first step, which is see all beings as having been our mothers or our parents, our fathers. Now, this is a really fresh idea. I never heard of this idea before I came to Dharma. I was thinking about that today. I had no idea about this idea. It would have never occurred to my brain. Isn't that amazing? Except that this is a very fresh idea. We don't run around with people say, hey, you know, why don't you just think of everyone as having been your mother? You know, we go, Anyway, for Westerners, of course, there's a couple obstacles here. And the first one is that we can be a little bit skeptical about the idea of rebirth. But in Buddhism, we believe there's a beginningless mind stream, and there is absolutely no scientific proof that the mind is only in the brain, that it's an organ and it drops dead, you know, and then no mind. In fact, the mind is non-material, it's consciousness. And Venerable has talked about this wonderfully in this book called I Wonder Why, and I just wanted to read just a couple pieces out of it about the mind. Each moment of mind is a continuation of the previous moment and depends on what we just did. Our present mind is a continuation of yesterday's mind. So there's no beginning to it. Who said there has to be a beginning? The continuity is infinite. This may be difficult to grasp initially, but if you use the example of the number line, you know, it goes infinitely in both directions. Infinite negative numbers, infinite positive numbers, and there's no end to it. So we have that idea of something going on endless, you know, even in Western science, and we can apply that to our minds and purify our mind stream. It's impossible for the mind stream to have a beginning. Each moment of mind is caused by the previous moment. If there was a beginning, it would mean either that the first moment has no cause. Is that possible? First moment of mind, no cause? Does anything arise that way? So, or it was caused by something else besides a previous moment of mind. Now, what would that be? So, this is a little bit about why we believe in rebirth, that the consciousness goes on, and there's a lot more to be studied about that. One teacher said to me, and I found it very helpful when I was quite skeptical about rebirth in the early days, was just try it on. You know, just try it on. You know, you don't have to fight with whether the idea of rebirth is scientifically proven or we know or anyone knows, but just try it on for a while and see what it might answer for you, what it might explain, what it might open up. And I found for me, especially, what was very, very helpful was it answered a question of why good things happen to bad people. And I'm putting quotes around good and bad. But that whole idea of, well, why did that baby die? Or why did that person who was so kind have that get robbed? Or, you know, these things that would just puzzle me and throw me into a frenzy and make me think the world was very randomly cruel. And when you start thinking of beginningless time, well, this is karma rising from way, way back. Both good, bad, and neutral karma is going to rise up for such a long time. The other thing, I will skip forward a little bit, but what this is all about is lessening our attachment to what we currently see and what we look like right now. And Venerable was very, very clear about that. Like when you look at a person, you can think, this is not the form they always have had. This is not the way they've always appeared. So it kind of loosens up, and then we don't get stuck so quick on reacting to one another. And then she tells this wonderful story about one lama, I can't remember his name, you might remember, but the one who went around and talks to the animals and says, "Hi, Mother," to like Lama Atisha would see the little donkey or say, "Hi, Mother." And I've tried that with a few insects when I've come on them, and it's really fun. I mean, it's just really a fun, uplifting thing to do, to look at something small that you might react negatively towards and instead just go, "Well, hi, little Mother." And then all of a sudden your relationship feels quite different. So we can just try this on. So that's the first step, regarding everyone as having been our mother, our parents, our father. The second one is to recollect the kindness of our parents. Now, this can be difficult in the West too, because we have all this psychological work that we've done since Freud about the mothers kind of being problems and parents causing our psychological problems and all of this. And seeing them somehow as the cause of our pain and neuroses. But Venerable talks about, and this has been a really good meditation for me as a parent, and then in helping my mother die as she was like close to 102 and living in her own house, to remember how difficult parenting is. Parenting is really, really hard work. I mean, first of all, you are going to wake up every single night, not just one, but every single night at least once, and sometimes two times, and sometimes three times, and your baby throws up on you, and your baby cries, and they don't give you anything nice when you wake up. They want things, and they need things, and you give them. But this is while at the same time you're often working at another job that you have to show up for, sleepy or not, tired or not, and you're showing up for that job to get enough money to pay for the child. I read one time when I was doing divorce mediation that it cost $100,000, and that was in the 90s, to raise a child to age 18 at a middle class level. So that parent has to earn that much more money than a single person does. So they have to work and take care of the child and run a house. And so now you can see why parents sometimes go around like looking a little zombie. So if we think of our parents did these things for us, and if they couldn't do them, then they put us in places where others could take care of us. And so that great kindness that they had all the time. And so you can think specifically, very specifically, it's really helpful. What kind of special things did they do? For me, my parents were working poor parents. They both worked all the time, but we were always in the lower class, you know, in that parts of town and stuff. It didn't matter as a kid because you think everyone around you is just like you are. But one of the amazing things they did as I did this meditation and started looking is they managed to come up with the tuition to send us to Catholic school. And the Catholic schools in our town were way, way better than the public school. They were less crowded. We learned Latin at age 6. We were memorizing catechisms. I mean, the education was like this to this. And they did that. They like struggled through working in a service station, working as a nurse's aide, working as a cook at a school to pay tuition for three of us to go to Catholic school. I don't know how they did that. I mean, now I look back and I am just incredibly grateful to them for that. So the other thing is, you know what? It's just time for us to forgive our parents. We need to grow up. I mean, I just was meditating on this and thought, you know, the key thing is it's just time to forgive our parents. They did their best. They had all kinds of conditions and causes, and all through that they helped us anyway in the very best way they knew. And we have the results today of being where we're at because of what they did, you know. So we can cherish them and see their kindness. And if we don't and we stay angry, what kind of mind do we have? We don't even have our own happiness. We don't have any building blocks to getting towards bodhicitta. So the goal of these first steps is to move your heart to the feeling of kindness. It can't be a neck-up thing. We got to get to the feeling, like actually feeling the kindness of them. And when you do, when you feel the kindness of someone, your heart goes automatically to step three. And this is great because we don't have to work at it. It's the wish to repay. It rises up just spontaneously. And if it doesn't, then go back to steps one and two. That's the key, is just go back to steps one and two. Not like you failed at them, but just go back there until this kindness, this warm-hearted kindness rises up. And Geshe Tekchok says, the very best kindness we can give to anyone is to practice the Dharma. And, you know, I really had to face this in my decision to move to the Abbey. I just fought myself around for 2 or 3 years, really wanting to come here, and then feeling like it wouldn't be kind to my mother, it wouldn't be kind to my son, who is grown and didn't need me in that way anyway, it wouldn't be kind to my partner, it wouldn't be kind to my friends of 30 years if I went off to the Abbey. And I kept meditating on it, and then I thought, you know, it's really the kindness of this life versus the kindness of many lives. And if I'm looking long-term what I can give them, if I can improve my mind, if I can move towards these grand concepts, move towards being a bodhisattva, this is the best gift I can give them, because when I meet them in the next life, then I could be of much greater benefit. And this is only this life. So this one's going by quickly. So this is really important to know what Geshe Tekchok and Venerable are saying. What is the best gift we can give ourselves? What's the best gift we can give to others? So now with these steps 1 through 3, we have a real firm base for bodhicitta, and we begin to get the actual mind of it, which starts, Geshe Tekchok says, with this heartwarming love. So we need to see all sentient beings in beauty. I love that phrase. I don't know why. You know, see them in beauty. And, you know, it's not about physical beauty. You could be looking at, I don't know, Attila the Hun or something. Even know who Attila the Hun is, but anyway, that was a phrase from childhood, or the Hulk, or any, you know, a spider, a tarantula. But to see this being in beauty is to hold this being as lovable. And the only way I can get there is to say, this was my mother, or this person was very kind to me in the past. Sometimes I can't get to my mother because our relationship was a bit dicey. By the end, it was kind, and that was lovely. But I can see them maybe as having been my brother, who I could see his kindness very clearly, much more clearly in life. So I can say, this was my brother in my past life. You know, this was one of my best friends. There they are again. And they're just in this form. So I worked on this a lot with our past president, George Bush, trying to find a way to find some heartwarming love. And that was a great challenge. And I got a little closer to neutral out of my anger. And that I did that by just seeing him as a younger brother of mine. You know, that this is, he's been my brother many, many times, and I'd really love to take care of him, and I'd love to guide him, and I'd love to help him. And so that was really helped cool that down. And there are many, many interesting stories. The one that's sticking in my mind right now about showing up with this kind of heartwarming love in the world is one I told on the when Venerable was teaching, but it's a quick one, I'll tell it again. There was a woman in Washington, D.C. I was rooming with when we went to Kala Chakra, and she was telling about this friend and how this friend goes around the world and just seems to interact with everybody on buses, in stores, just kind of some kind of open-hearted, not a Buddhist, but an open-hearted person. And she said one day there was a bunch of people on the bus, and the woman telling me, Gail was on the bus with the friend, and there was a woman who was kind of talking to herself and kind of building up and seeming very disturbed and building up to, you know, some kind of an episode, kind of talking angrily to herself with someone who maybe wasn't there and talking about dragons and they're going to get you and scaring herself and, of course, scaring people on the bus. And people were kind of edging away and everything. And this other woman, whose name I don't remember, just went right over and smiled at her and scooted right in, and she said, "Hi, did you know the dragons aren't here today?" Poof, they went. Gail said it was just amazing, and the woman started interacting with her in quite a normal way, and they started looking in their bags at stuff, and what do you have, and what do I have, and that's amazing. Now, that's heartwarming love. That's like seeing that woman as someone who's interesting, who's beautiful, who I want to make connection with. That's what that is. So when we can do that, we move towards this. And the fifth step is cultivating compassion, the wish for others to be free of all sufferings. And to do this, we have to go back to the first of the Four Noble Truths and really go through and see the suffering, the intense suffering that beings go through. We can even just look at our own lives. It's not been a picnic, folks. You know, I mean, even if you had the very best kind of upbringing materially, you don't have to look long to find war, famine, you know, protests, someone homeless, someone suffering, and we feel that suffering. Even if we protect ourselves from it with our material goods, we feel it. There's a saying my friend Sister Guadalupe, a Catholic nun, she would say, "Oh yeah, we have a saying about this in Latin America. The poor go to bed hungry and the rich go to bed worried." So nobody's free, you see, of this. You know, the rich are worried. What are those poor planning? You know, how long can I hold on to this? How can I protect it? Do I need to build my wire fence higher? So, you know, we're all affected. So we think deeply about this and wish in the very deepest way for this suffering to end. And then the sixth step is the great resolve. And so now we're really moving on it. Now we say, "I'm going to take personal responsibility to free others." And this is how Geshe Thekchok says it: "I myself will free sentient beings from suffering. I myself will give happiness to these sentient beings. The first is the great resolve of compassion, and the second is the great resolve of love." He says we call these great because it's a powerful decision to bring this about your own self. And what gets in the way? Our old friend, our self-centered attitude. So I just, you know, that mind goes, "Oh yeah, right, blah, 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 blah," and starts nibbling away. And then I go, "Oh, wait a minute. If I go with you nibbling away at me, I know the ditch I'm going to be in. Or I've been there. Oh, I'm discouraged again. I can't really do this. Geshe Jampa Tekcho can do it, but I can't do it. Okay, I'm sick of that, all right?" So we don't have to go there. And we can just simply say, this is possible. There are beings that have cultivated this. This is possible. And again, we have to be around and bring to mind the models over and over. So it's holiness. If you haven't had a chance to be in his presence, make your best effort to do that, because there is a model on the earth of someone living this out. And then, of course, the teachers were around. Geshe Jampa Tekchok, you know, so many, and Venerable herself, so many just holding this beautiful bodhicitta mind. Geshe Pelge, so many who've come to visit here. Geshe Tensor Wangdak, so many, many beings that we get to see. Tenzin Palmo, on and on we could go. So which mind do you want to have? The stuck, discouraged mind fallen in the ditch? No. Or the mind uplifted by the models that are here on earth, Lama Zopa. And so then we can just do what we were talking about today. Take refuge over and over when that discouraged mind comes up, the the piranhas nibbling away at the, you know, the beginnings of the great resolve, saying, oh, you can't do it, you know, just move out of the way, and bring in this mind of following those that we cherish, that we see how they are in the world, and we want to be that way, seeing they've been able to do it, and they're just humans. That's what we are. We're humans. So we can do this. So we take refuge over and over to move forward. And then we end up in bodhicitta. Now this begins when we see that we can't even free ourselves right now, and we can't get happiness for our own selves. So we wonder, can anyone do this? And again, we're looking around for who can. And we see that the Buddha can. And we study the qualities of the Buddha. We see that they're infinite, pure, and powerful. And they see the dispositions of every single being. So they're always being effective and skillful in helping. And this is what we want. We can do it. And our teachers wouldn't lie to us about this. They say we can. They have very, very strong vows against telling lies. And so they would not make this up. And we can do this. When this aspiration to be a Buddha is very firm, then we've generated bodhicitta in our mind stream. That primary mind intent on the welfare of others that inspires us to full awakening. So I'm going to read one last paragraph from Geshe Thekchul, because he tells us something very important about how to think about this. And it was helpful to me. He says, he closes this part and he says, we must not think superficially about the altruistic intention. That's the phrase he's using for bodhicitta. We must not allow it to become banal. And, you know, like just every day, whatever. If we think, I've heard about bodhicitta so much, it's nothing special, then its power will vanish in our minds. Bodhicitta is the indispensable seed of enlightenment. And if we remember this, our mind will find the very idea of bodhicitta moving. And we then will be happy to hear about it. And we will think, even if I can't generate bodhicitta at present, I respect and admire this amazing attitude. As much as possible, I want to train my mind in this thought, which is the source of happiness for the world. So that's it. We hope to see you next week, when Venerable will be back in this lovely hot seat. So we'll do our dedication. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born and nor decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions and especially Ashravasti Abbey in the West flourish.